This is the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media. Now, here's Jason Jones.
Aloha, everybody, and welcome to the Jason Jones Show. I am your host, Jason Jones. And I want to say, we've almost been into 2021 for a week, almost. But I would like to welcome you. Welcome to 2021. My name is Jason Jones. I will be your tour guide for the year. And here's what I promise you. 2021 is going to be a year of adventure. G.K. Chesterton said, "An inconvenience is an adventure rightly understood." And an adventure is an inconvenience correctly understood. So what I'm trying to say is it will be a year of inconvenience, but we will understand it correctly, and it will be an adventure. 2021 is also going to be a great year, a great year. I didn't say good. I didn't say pleasant. I said great. I hope good. I hope pleasant. But more importantly, I know it's going to be great. And by that, I mean you, me. Those of us who listen to the show, I know, will be ordering our life in a way that is thoughtful to our posterity, that we are going to plant trees in 2021. We're going to plant trees. We're going to plant orchards so that our posterity has shade. They have the blessings of liberty that we had. So we're going to look back to our posterity with gratitude. And we know that with privilege comes duty, and we're going to look to our posterity, and we commit to living a great year, sailing across the next 12 months, attacking across these tumultuous seas in a way that we know we can put our posterity down in a pleasant cove. That's what 2021 is going to be. I am in Washington, D.C. right now for the March to Save America events. Go to marchtosaveamerica.com. See all that's happening. I'll be speaking at Freedom Plaza today in a bit. Tomorrow I'll be at the Ellipse and at the Capitol building with many, many, many great Americans. My buddy Ali Alexander is the organizer of March to Save America. My good friend Arena, who was on the show a couple weeks ago, is organizing Jericho March events all around Washington, D.C. It is a busy time. It's a great time. I think the president is joining us tomorrow. It's quite exciting, and it will impress my in-laws to be on stage with the president. I hope he does come. But today is not about politics. Today is about you. We're going to take a little break. It's about you and your New Year's resolutions. Now, if you're like me, in 2020, I weighed 220 pounds. Right? And I said, I'm going to get down to 210. Well, right now, I weigh 230. Okay, so I went up. I didn't go down. So now it's a year later, and now my New Year's resolution, among others, is I am going to get down to 220 pounds, which means I'll probably end up 240. But you know, as all of my resolutions go, that's the tough one. I have easier ones, which is A, this is the year. This is the year we free the Uyghur. Free the Uyghur, free the world. Close those concentration camps. If we allow, the world is beginning to know the horrors that the CCP is doing to its minorities and people in occupied countries like East Turkestan. We cannot tolerate this anymore. Free the Uyghur from the CCP. Free the Uyghur from the CCP. I need to say that clearly. Free Hong Kong. We free the world. Free the world from the CCP. This year, we're going to free the world from the yoke of the neoliberals. These are my goals. But today, we're going to be focusing on those things that are very important to all of us. You know, how do we be more ordered and disciplined at work? How do we be present for my family? That is my biggest thing I pray for, I strive to do. Be present when I'm with my children. Stop thinking about work. Stop thinking about payroll. Stop thinking about invoices coming in. Focus on my children. Give them the same respect I give people that I do business with, that I work with, to honor their time. You know, how do we do that? How do we order our lives in a way to achieve our goals? Well, our guest today is Hector Colon. He is the perfect guest for this show. He was a multi-time, I think seven-time national boxing champion. And at the height of his career, he walked away from the boxing ring, hung up his boxing gloves because Hector wanted to serve God and he wanted to serve his neighbor. He wrote this powerful book, a beautiful book. It was a book I felt like he wrote it just for me, and it was called My Journey. It is called My Journey from the Boxing Ring to the Boardroom, Five Virtues for Life and Leadership. You know, when he was getting into the business world, he realized he didn't even have words for things like, you know, when you get punched after the bell and you don't lash out, you just go back to your corner. What's that called? Practicing restraint. Oh, that's temperance. In the third round, when you get your bell rung and you want to take a knee and call it a day, but you keep going, what's that called? Well, that's never giving up. When you get your restaurant open and you're just finally starting to make things, then the government shuts you down again. You want to quit? You want to give up? What's that called? You don't? Oh, that's called perseverance. Willing to take risks, courage. Putting others first, humility. So we go through all these five principles. I'm not going to go through them here. With the great Hector Colon. So he's our guest. And this episode is being brought to you by Movie to Movement, creating a culture of life, love, and beauty through the power of film. Go to movietomovement.com and you can click on through and watch our movie, Divided Hearts of America, starring Benjamin Watson, that has the secret that will unite America. NFL champ, Super Bowl champ, Benjamin Watson takes us on a tour of American history to discover the secret that will unite us. Go to movietomovement.com. You can watch it on pay-per-view. We got some big news about some other places. You'll be able to watch the film coming up soon. And here's what I need you to do. This episode is also being brought to you by the Vulnerable People Project. The Vulnerable People Project stands in solidarity with the most vulnerable people in the world. We were the first organization on Earth when Italy was in lockdown to alert to the challenges to food security that these shutdowns were going to impose on the most vulnerable. We have worked shoulder to shoulder with the Uyghur for years and years, fighting for the Christians in Iraq and Iran and Syria, fighting for the child in the womb. You want to be a monthly donor to the Vulnerable People Project. So go to thegreatcampaign.org for your monthly gift of $20 or more. You get a free copy of my book with John Smirak, The Race to Save Our Century. We are also being brought to you by, you know it, MyPillow. I'm on the road. I'm not one of those guys that's going to travel with a pillow. You know, I'm not going to wear Spanx or I'm not going to wear pajamas on a plane. I'm a grown man. I'm not going to travel with a pillow. Have you ever seen those guys, grown men, traveling with a pillow? I know movie stars that they love their MyPillow so much that they have their staff. These are people I know. They have their staff FedEx their pillow to their posh hotel. So when they get to their five-star hotel, they got that five-star pillow, that MyPillow waiting for them. That's decadent. I am not there yet in life where I can FedEx a pillow. My wife, I think, would lose all. She would look at me a little cross-eyed if she saw me FedExing pillows to hotels. But, you know, I would if I could. MyPillow is the best pillow in the world. And you can get it now with a deep discount by going to MyPillow.com and clicking on the radio listener box and use the code Jones. Here's another reason why I want you to go to MyPillow.com. Guess who is speaking at the March to Save America with me? Mike Lindell, the founder of MyPillow. Not only does he make the greatest pillow in the world, the best mattress topper ever, you got to get the mattress topper. Love my mattress topper. You got to go to MyPillow.com, click on the radio listener square, use the code Jones and get the mattress topper. But you got to get at least a pillow today for yourself. You probably got the pillow. You got to get it as a gift. One of the reasons why is, A, we need to stand with Mike Lindell because that man has courage. His products are made in America. They're made in his hometown. They're made in his state, Minnesota. He doesn't partner with distributors in China that use forced labor like so many other brands. No. He hires his own. But more importantly, not only is he an ethical businessman, he is a great citizen. So he is what this show is about. He's also a guy that was vulnerable himself not that long ago. He is the example of what a vulnerable person is. A vulnerable person, Mike Lindell, is the model. This who the most vulnerable people in the world are often the strongest people in the world. The strongest, just placed in challenging situations. Mike Lindell struggled with addiction. And from the midst of that, built an empire and now lives a life of service. He's my man. So go to MyPillow.com, click on the radio listener box, use the code Jones for deep discounts. This is the first show of the year. We've got some big programs coming up, but this show is just for you and for me so we can hit those goals that we are setting for ourselves for 2021 in this year that is going to be one big, great adventure. So here we go, Hector Colon on the Jason Jones Show. Aloha, Hector Colon. Welcome to the Jason Jones Show.
Hello, Jason. Very happy to be here with you today.
Yeah, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Yes, Merry Christmas to you and your family as well. And Happy New Year. And I hope this is going to be a great year.
No, pray God, it will be a good year, right? Even if we have to stand on these stumbling blocks and make them stepping stones. And that's why you are my first guest for the first year. A friend of mine who's a national bank president, big shot, told me about your book about a month ago. I read it like that weekend, and I was looking for an opportunity to have you on. And I thought, you know what? I want Hector to be my first guest for the new year. Your book is like, I felt like you wrote this book just for me. You know, when I read it, I said, this is like if someone wrote a book just for me, it has everything I love. It has my Catholic faith. It has boxing, and it looks at boxing. As I always say, sports are a sacramental in a way. They're like a secular sacramental, and that it's a sign in time on how you live your life. So when you're a young man, sports for you are an opportunity to develop those virtues in time, in this little slice of time in your childhood and your young adulthood that you will then use for the rest of your life to be a servant leader. And that is what your book is all about, my journey from boxing to the boardroom. Well, hold on. I'm just pulling it up here. My journey from the boxing ring to the boardroom is the perfect book for those of us who we've all made our resolutions, and most of us are going to be done with our resolutions by week two. You know, as a guy that hangs out at gyms, I don't hang out in gyms the first 2 weeks of January. I'm like, I'm just going to run every day and do push-ups and pull-ups at the park. But they'll clear out. They'll clear out by the third week of January. So for those of us who are making resolutions for our physical health, our spiritual health, to be better, more attentive spouses, parents, to be more useful to our employers or our employees, this is the perfect book. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here with you, Jason.
So writing a book is not an easy thing, and you have your hands full with your job, yeah, as a parent and husband. What motivated you to write this book?
Yeah, thank you. You know, a few things. One, I got a lot of encouragement along the way to write a book, to just share my story. And I really wanted to inspire those individuals that had similar challenges to mine growing up, to give them hope that they can overcome those challenges and do something really good with their lives. The other thing was, I wanted to, expand my personal apostolate and reach in this world. And I think that through my book, I can inspire others to do better things in life, be a better husband, be a better father, be a better CEO. Just generally, I was hoping to touch more people than what I'm currently touching today. And then third, you'll see examples of how I've led through a servant leadership philosophy. And I hope to inspire leaders that are wanting to have better results and achieve better success for their employees and results, that they can look at some of the examples and approaches that I've taken to inspire them to lead in a different way through values and virtues.
Now, when you mentioned your personal apostolate, do you have like a mission statement for yourself, for your personal apostolate?
Yeah, it's essentially I want to sanctify my work, sanctify myself through the work, and sanctify others through my work. And my work starts at home with my family, then goes into my professional life as a CEO, and then expands into the community.
And now you work in human services, social services. You run a big ministry. When I read your book, I always try to find like what is the inciting incident or what was your call to adventure? And so there were three instances in the book. And I wonder which one would you say is your call to adventure? If I'm going to make the 30 for 30 on the life of Hector Colon or a movie on your life. So I sort of had three. I had one, I think is the Polish boy, Adam. Is that his name? Adam?
Yep.
So the Polish boy who bopped you in the nose.
Not his real name, but yes.
I didn't think so. I was like, Adam. I never met a Polish kid named Adam. I met a lot of Polish kids. I never met an Adam. So you had him punch you in the nose. Then you had your father who was like a very responsible, loving, and attentive father. But he left. He went back home. And maybe we could talk a little bit about that. And then you had your sister's battle with mental illness. So would you say those were the three streams that poured into the river of your apostolate, or was there one, and am I missing anything? Or was there one that just sort of was, when you look back, this was what it was. This is what set me on my journey.
Yeah. I think clearly being bullied, you know, that's what led me to the boxing ring. And my coach, Israel Acosta, really instilled a lot of confidence in me when he put me in front of the mirror and started showing me some combinations. And he told my father, your son's a natural. He's going to become a champion. So that belief through my coach, Israel Acosta, being bullied, yes. Then I also want to mention Israel Acosta Shorty, who played a huge role in my life. You mentioned my father. He was a good father while I was here, but yes. Then he left when I was 12 years old, and I had to become very independent quickly in life, you know, obtaining a paper route and another job so I can help my mother. So I learned, you know, business and how to hustle and how to earn a living to support others. And the other person, and my sister, like you said, you know, just later on in life, how she was addicted to drugs, but then when it really counted, when she wanted to make sure that she could see my daughter, she stopped. And that was a powerful experience that temperance and self-control when it really mattered for her and for our family. I thought that was really special.
Do you think if the boxing gym wasn't there for you, that was a necessary ingredient and Shorty to help you persevere through all of that trauma? So as all this trauma was happening, your dad left, your sister's battling mental illness, and in my family, like in all of our families, maybe this is something we can talk about, because I think you and I had that experience of coming from broken homes, then we find ourselves in the rarefied air of very successful people, and I don't know about you, but I always felt like out of place, and if they only knew who I really was. But then you discover that all these families have the same problems our families have, right? All that's different is, you know, what they drive, the neighborhood they live in.
Right. But
do you think that the boxing was the necessary, like it helped you, sheltered you in a way, kept you focused on some light at the end of the tunnel as all this was happening around you?
Yeah. You know, I want to start off with saying first that we have, you know, in society, we have so much in common. You know, one in four of us has a mental illness. Over 50%, of people come from broken families. So we're in the mix with lots of people from that perspective. But yes, for me, boxing is what really, you know, provided me with the right structure to stay positive in life. You know, if I wasn't involved in boxing, could my life have taken a different path? you know, maybe that's why I'm so thankful to Adam for bullying me, because that's what got me to the boxing room where I learned the virtues of magnanimity, you know, striving for greatness, humility, about serving others, courage, which is about facing your fears, perseverance, not giving up, and temperance, self-control, and restraint. I learned all of those virtues through boxing that has helped me so much in my life. So I'm so thankful to Adam. I'm so thankful for the sport of boxing and the influence it has had on my life.
Now, have you ever, do you know where Adam is? Now, in the world of social media, we can be connected to everyone we ever knew. Have you ever checked out what Adam's up to?
You know, I haven't. So I haven't seen Adam since probably I was 15 years old. But if I saw him, I'd thank him, I'd hug him, and I'd be very grateful. You know, when we ended up being friends, you know, I wouldn't say really, really close or good friends, but we played together. You know, I ended up beating him up a couple of times, so he didn't mess with me anymore once I learned how to box.
Well, and it's funny how people have their memories. You know, Adam, because you beat him up those last couple of times, he might look back and think of you as the bully and forget that he was the guy that, that picked on you, right? That's how people's memories are, right? It's amazing how many great fighters started with bullying. I know George St. Pierre was bullied relentlessly, and he tells the story of one day he was in Toronto, and the kid that beat him up every day, he pulled up, I think, in his Ferrari or whatever he was driving. And there was a homeless guy, and he rolled, you know, and he went out of his car to give this homeless guy money on the side of the road. And it was the boy, it was the kid that used to beat him up.
Wow.
And and one of the things we never know is what's going on in the homes of these kids who are bullies, which is something that you did. It was, I thought it was very empathetic. You said he'd call you all these names, and you knew that these were words he picked up at home. Did you know that as a kid, or is this something you reflected on as an adult? Because I thought that was a great bit of empathy there, to know that this kid didn't conjure up calling you these names on his own. He'd learned it.
You know, I think it was a little bit of both. I think more later on in life, I truly reflected on that and realized that more than ever. But I did realize it a little bit because I met his father, and his father was honestly just a real jerk. You know, he used to look at me with this mean face of disgust and as if he couldn't stand me. And I remember as a young child thinking, wow, what does this guy have against me, you know? So I'd say it's a little bit of both.
Yeah, what's strange is, and this is in the 70s and 80s, and they were Polish immigrants as well? Were they immigrants?
You know, their grandparents were, I believe.
So they were facing their own sort of discrimination. That's what... Was that normal in Milwaukee? So when I was a kid growing up in the South Side, in the suburbs of Chicago, every word was racial. Your friend wasn't Polish, he was a Polak. Your friend wasn't Irish, he was a Mick. Your friend wasn't Italian, he was a Dago. And, you know, if somebody was cheap, they were trying to Jew you down or they gypped you. Everything was racially charged. You know, was that how it was when you were a boy, like in Milwaukee? Like think about it. Like, we modified everything with a word that was racially charged growing up, but we had no clue what we were saying.
Yeah, that is true in Milwaukee. You know, the other thing that's very true in Milwaukee, and you may know this, is that we're one of the most segregated cities in the entire nation. So Latinos live in one area, you know, the whites live in another area, African Americans, blacks live in another area. And I think that's really unfortunate. I think, you know, it's better when we integrate and we learn from one another and we love one another and work with each other to develop a better society for the common good of all.
Well, I want to get to these virtues you learned as a boxer that you brought to the boardroom. But before I do, you're Catholic and you're a boxer. One of the things I love about boxing gyms is one of the things I love about the Catholic Church. When you walk into a boxing gym, it's the most diverse place in the world. And right? Like when you walk into a Catholic church. A lot of other sports are almost very segregated, like a lot of denominations are very segregated. Right. But when you walk into a boxing gym, not only is it diverse, it all goes out the window. It doesn't even matter anymore. And it's like a fraternity. Same thing about the Catholic Church, right? So you walk into a Catholic church, there's the Dominican lady, there's the Puerto Ricans, there's the Irish, there's the Italians, there's the Polish, there's the Nigerians, and you're all there in your family, and it's just like that in a boxing gym. When I travel the country, the world, the two places I have to go to, when you're from Milwaukee, I go to Rufus Sport. I love Rufus Sport. And every city I go to, I have to go to Mass, and I have to find a boxing gym. And no matter what I'm doing, I'm going to give a speech at Yale, you know, and I feel out of place. But then I go to the boxing gym, I go to Mass, and I feel right at home. Is that something you see a similar sort of the of the two?
I love that, you know, and I remember just growing up in boxing. We were white, we were brown, we were black, but we all wanted to become champions. You know, we were all poor, and we wanted to aspire to great things. And, you know, we would travel all over the world, and we didn't experience racism, or we didn't feel like we were different. We were champion boxers. We wanted to be the best. And similarly, like you said, you go to church and you're white, you're brown, you're black, and you're there for Jesus and to learn more about him and to bring those values, those virtues to society. So I agree with that. I like that a lot.
Yeah, my two favorite plays, it's like when I step into a boxing gym or when I step into Mass, I can breathe easy. Is that your dog? Your dog is having a bad day.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yes. There was a car here, so he did, the car left, so he should be, stop barking shortly.
No, that's okay. So, yeah, it's so let's go over these virtues.
Yep.
So what are the five virtues that you learned as a boxer that we can apply? Now we've all made our New Year's resolutions. Like I made a New Year's resolution last year to get down to 210 pounds. I was 220. Now it's a year later and I weigh 230. Okay, so this is how it goes. I went the wrong direction. I didn't go down, I went up. So as we make these resolutions, we want to commit ourselves to them. Again, and it's always with like servant leadership as well, right? Like I think for most of us, we make these resolutions to be better employees, employers, spouses, parents, more useful to our parish. As we're setting out to do this, how do we apply these virtues that you were learning as a boxer, didn't know they had names probably. And then when you became Catholic, or when you became really connected to your faith, you looked back and is that what happened? You looked back and said, oh, this is the word that goes with what I learned. Is that how it happened?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the first one, and very relevant for New Year's resolutions, is magnanimity. And that's really about striving for greatness. Alexander Haybar just wrote a book on personal greatness, and he says that the virtue of magnanimity is that virtue of striving for personal excellence. And for me, I think it's really about those daily habits, those daily rituals, and those daily routines that helps you achieve this virtue. And when you're a boxer, you're trying to become a champion. Nothing but number one or the champion is ever good enough. I don't care who you are. If you get into that ring and you're at the elite status and you have the ability to become a champion and you lose, even though you might be number two in the world or three in the world or top 10, you might think that's good. But when you're training with the intensity and the desire and the tenacity to be the champion. So that's very applicable to us in life, you know, whether it's meeting a resolution, whether it's striving for holiness in your Catholic faith. I mean, you got to have daily practices, daily rituals to achieve that sanctity, to achieve the best you possibly can be. Same thing as in if you're a husband, a father, you know, we got to do things to strive to be better each and every day so that those that are around us or surround us can feel the impact of your spirit, that spirit of magnanimity.
And would you say humility is key, right? It's a key to being magnanimous?
Absolutely. Those are my two favorite virtues. And humility at its core and tradition of Catholic and Christian scripture is about serving others. We know that Jesus Christ came into this world, and you know, some might not believe that he's our Lord and Savior, but he's arguably the most influential person in the history of the world. And he didn't come as king. He didn't come as dictator or ruler. He came as a humble servant leader and showed us a way of life. And humility, I learned a lot about humility through my mother. When my father left, I had never heard her complain. Not once did I hear her complain. And not only did she not complain, but we were poor. My mother has a seventh grade education and worked three jobs to support us. But not only support us, brought in the homeless, served my sister's boyfriends that had mental illnesses, you know, made sure they had clothes and food and make sure they were taking their medications. So I learned humility and servant leadership through my mother, but also through my coach. My coach spent his nights with me. I played baseball, and I would come home late to the gym, and he'd be there at 7 o'clock waiting for me. He'd sacrifice his weekends and his vacations for me. He actually took me into his own home when I was 16 years old because he was afraid that I had some friends, and he didn't like, you know, he was worried that I could go in the wrong direction. So he took me into his own home where he loved me, fed me, and made sure I could be a champion both in and out of the ring.
Was it that he brought you, was this after you got arrested? The story you tell about getting arrested, is that when he brought you into his home?
That's right. That's right. And he was so upset with me. So I got arrested because I was with a group of friends, and we went out to eat a Pizza Hut, and we didn't have money, so we ran out. We were running, you know, I think it was over an hour, and finally I got caught and went to the sheriff's office, and so my mother didn't know how to get to where I was at, so I called my coach Shorty, and he was so upset. He didn't talk to me for several weeks, and I was just hurt because I viewed Shorty Israel Acosta, who's really a giant in my life. He's been a giant in this community to so many people, and I really respected him as like a second father. And I pleaded with him. I said, please forgive me. And yes, that's when he took me into his house, home, and I lived with him for about a year.
So just... So describe it in a word. So if we're aspiring for magnanimity, to be magnanimous, so what is that? Because that's the one that's in a sentence. So I'm writing these down as you're talking.
Yep. When I say magnanimity, I'm saying that striving for greatness.
Striving for greatness. And then that you have to be humble, because to strive for greatness, you have to be willing to learn from others, to acknowledge your flaws. Right. If you're not, I was a young man, I was a fighter, and I was very athletic, but I was not humble. And I look back and I see that there were fighters that lacked my athleticism and my power, but because of their humility, I limited my ability to succeed. And I remember I read a George St. Pierre's autobiography, and he said, you know, his goal when he trains is to lose every round he spars.
Wow.
So when he'll bring in wrestlers to wrestle, the best wrestlers in the world, because his goal is to lose. Like if he's not losing, he's not learning. And he brings in the world's best boxers to box. And he says, and when I spar an MMA guy in the ring, leading training for a fight, if they're a great stand-up fighter, I stay on my feet. If they're the world's best jiu-jitsu player, I take it to the ground. He said, now when I get in the ring or the octagon and it's for money and the lights are on and the belt is on the line, I do the opposite. I put my strength to their weakness. And when I read that, I remember I was never even willing to lose a round in training. I would do the opposite. If it was a good, you know, a good stand-up fighter, I'm going to stay standing up. If they're good in zone two, I'm going to stay in zone three. this is, and they're just training. No one's even watching. It's just two of us, but it's in my head. I don't even want to lose a round. Did you have that kind of humility that GSP talks about? Is it because you were a champion when you were sparring, or were you, did you have that then, or was it something you've acquired later?
No, I always felt that, you know, well, boxing will humble you if you wanted to or not. That will just happen in boxing. But the thing you'll learn in boxing, even though you're it's one-on-one, right? So a lot of people think, well, this ain't a team sport. This is just one-on-one and you have to train so hard. But you know what? It is a team sport because you have a coach that is there for you, that's training you, that's bringing out the best in you. You have sparring partners. If you didn't have those sparring partners, there's no way you can achieve your best. You have fans and supporters that are encouraging you. You're their hope. So you have so much support around you that helps you become the champion that you are. So I actually learned that in boxing. And that's why they're serving you. And I feel that when my mother served me, when Shorty served me, you know, it brought out the best in me. And that's why I believe in that, in the virtue of humility and really that servant leadership philosophy in my professional life now, right now as a CEO. And I believe that that will bring out the best in individuals and in turn lead to extraordinary results.
That's beautiful. So what would you say is the second, or what's the second virtue?
So that second virtue is humility. And at its core, I believe that serving others. The more you serve and give to others, the more you'll get in return. And we need more of that in society, right? Because we live in a very selfish society. But if we reached out to others, try to bring out the best in them, and look at the common good, we'd be a better society.
Yeah, it's interesting. And then that links to the first virtue. If you don't have the second, the first can become just an exercise in your ego. Like in how you recognize that it's a team sport. And I always tell people boxing is a team sport. I mean, at every level, it's a team sport.
Right.
There's really no such thing as an individual sport in the world. When you see that guy lining up at the blocks for the race, he's got a team. He has a team behind him. So without that humility and servant leadership, it becomes an exercise in ego. You even look at someone like Mike Tyson and how his life really hit the rocks after he lost his coach. But then later in life, it's as if he found his bearing again with the lessons he learned from that coach of his youth, you know, that saved him later on. And so that's that team spirit. Now, grounded in servant leadership because of humility. What would you say is, and you say boxing humbles you. You talked about being so afraid, like who getting punched in the face, getting up early in the morning, especially in Milwaukee, packing your bag. It's running outside in the rain and it's dark and it's cold to get in a van, to go 2 hours up north, to sit around in a cold floor and wait your turn to get punched in the face doesn't sound like fun. You're like, that doesn't sound like fun. Whose idea of fun is this?
Right.
When did it become fun?
You know, I'd say when I won my first Junior Olympic National Championship. I was 14 years old. Won it at 106 pounds. You know, that I knew I was good. But then I won it the second year. And I won it at 125 pounds. So 1 year later, I won it back-to-back years. Then I look at the history books and I saw myself amongst the greatest, you know, that ever graced the ring and that won those Junior Olympic National Championships. So at that point, I think I felt that I had unique talents and that I could do something very special in the sport of boxing.
But was it fun? I mean, did it ever become fun for you?
Oh, you know, I wouldn't say boxing is fun. It's kind of weird. It's fun from the perspective of it's a science when you outbox your opponent and you use good defense and you're knocking the guy out. you know, there's an element of fun there, but it's hard to describe. It's not like, you know, basketball or baseball, you know, it's different. It's really different. And I think, you know, that as an MMA guy, it's fun, you know, when you win, and that sense of triumph and having those hands raised in front of thousands of people, you know, that's a good feeling. You know, you work so hard and you won. That's when it becomes fun, but it's not fun in the ring. It's not necessarily fun, you know, working out and the rigor and intensity that it takes to become a champion. So it's kind of hard to explain.
The sport is the price you pay for the community. Price you pay for the camaraderie. It's the price you pay for the solidarity. I think that's like so many things in life. I think it was William F. Buckley who said he was asked by Charlie Rose, "You've written so many books, you must love writing books." He goes, "I dread writing books." He says, "I love having written a book. I love having written a book." It's probably very similar for combat sports. It's you love having done that, and you love being part of the community. I don't know if you're in the Knights of Columbus. It's like the fight is an exemplification. It's an opportunity to learn. So what's our third virtue as we're getting ready to commit ourselves to our New Year's resolutions?
Yeah, courage. And that's really about facing your fears. And I'd have to say that there's no greater courage than entering into that ring. You go into that ring with intense fear, and I don't care who you are, the greatest to have ever graced a ring, you know, Muhammad Ali, Floyd Mayweather, they go into that ring. We go into that ring with fear. But it's really that dedication, that determination, and that discipline that gives you the confidence to enter into that ring. And again, when you win, that sense of triumph in front of all those people, it's a really good feeling. But I think that we have to have more courage in our society. You know, I learned courage in boxing, but I brought in courage into my life, you know, stepping into roles that maybe I wasn't entirely qualified for. But when I was given the opportunity, I applied that dedication, that determination, and that discipline that helped me be successful in those roles. If I wouldn't have had the courage, you know, I was a lobbyist with no lobbying background. When I was given the opportunity, I did great in that as a lobbyist. You know, I was a bank executive for the Director for Economic Development for WEDA, which is the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, the second largest bank by way of assets in the state of Wisconsin. I don't have an MBA. I don't have a finance background. I don't have a banking background. And yet I was given this extraordinary opportunity, and record numbers exist while I was there working with my team to bring more loans to disadvantaged businesses and low-income areas all across the state of Wisconsin. So having that courage to take on these different opportunities, and then applying that dedication, determination, and discipline to help you do well in those instances.
What, when you look back at your career or at boxing, what was the moment of dread? Was there ever a decision you ever had to make that you look back at that took the most courage, or was there ever an obstacle that you had to face and your courage failed you, that you look back and you think about that a lot?
Oh, man. And it hurts to this day, to be honest. You know, the 1992 Olympics, I should have been in the 1992 Olympics. And I didn't apply my whole heart and soul to becoming a part of the team. I wasn't focused mind, body, and spirit. I was 19 years old. I was distracted by just, you know, the lifestyle that boxing brings. And I was looking past the Olympics. I was like, I'm going to win the gold medal. I'm going to sign this multi-million-dollar contract. And the most important opportunity in my life that was right in front of me, I was not focused, and I lost. And it was devastating because I wasn't hearing from the big-time promoters about making millions and you know, nobody was contacting me. I wasn't, you know, in the media, and I was hurt. And that was such an important lesson for me, because now in life, I want to make sure if I have those opportunities, I'm ready and I'm prepared. And I apply that dedication, that determination and discipline, help me achieve my best self, right? And so that was a huge, awakening moment for me. Now, that guy that robbed me of my Olympic dreams, 6 months later, I fight him again. And that time I knocked him out in the first round for the U.S.
Championship. Who was that? Who was that?
That was Jesse Brasino.
Okay.
And he, he was a very awkward softball. You know, he beat me fair and square in the Olympic trials. It was a close fight, but he was just really awkward. And when I fought him the next time, I wanted to knock this guy out because he was so awkward. And a 3-round fight, you don't have that many rounds to figure someone out. So I knew that I needed to knock him out. And before I got into the ring, I envisioned a knockout, and that's what happened, like a minute and 35 seconds.
Now, the first round. Did he go on to the Olympics?
So he ended up losing. He was an alternate for the Olympics. He ended up losing to another individual, and I'm blanking on his name.
I know you fought Vernon Forrest several times. It wasn't Vernon.
Yeah. So this is what happened. So no, it was not Vernon. So Vernon and I were prospects and favorites to go to the Olympics at a 139. I beat Vernon Forrest twice. In 1991, he beat me a 3-2 decision. So two judges went for me and three judges went for him. I was devastated. So here I was so excited. I was going to make the Olympics at 139. I beat the best twice. And I'm feeling great. And I will tell you, though, that last time he beat me, I really thought I beat him. So I was just devastated. And what happened was I took some time off and I gained weight. And the next tournament that came around, I didn't have enough time to lose the weight. So I was like 144. And my coach said, come on, champ, we got to fight 47 then. And I was like, man, I could have been honestly a 132. I wasn't even a full 139, and I know I wasn't a 147. But I ended up doing it because I had to. So I ended up knocking everybody out at 147. So then my coach was like, champ, let's stay at 147. You look good here. Let's stay here. So that's what I ended up doing. I really should have been a 139er. And probably, fought off with Vernon Forrest for the Olympics, but I ended up staying at 147.
Well, you know, when I saw you fight, Vernon Forrest was a great fighter, all-time great fighter. I mean, he was just a wonderful fight and a beautiful human. And it seems like you two had similar interests, you know, and your concern for people with disability and struggling with mental illness. And then he was tragically murdered. And I would like to see someone do a 30 for 30 on his life. You know, maybe that's something we can do together. But yeah, he's just a beautiful human. And so you had to stand with this guy and you beat him twice.
Yeah.
One of the all-time great fighters. He was a
beautiful human being. Beautiful human being. You know, we were fierce in that ring. But, you know, we step out of that ring, we smile. You know, we weren't like really good friends, but we'd smile at each other, occasionally have some small talk. I knew he was a great human being. He knew I was a great human being. So I really love that about him. You know, in boxing and in combat sports, you know, some people will just really take it serious and will hate you and want nothing to do with you once you get outside of the ring. There are examples of that, but Vernon Forrest was not like that. He was a great human being.
Yeah, and I do think that when you see that in fighters, it's manifests itself because of fear. Or maybe it's almost like a virtue in them that they just can't treat it like a sport. They have to get themselves worked up. Maybe Tyson was like this because he talked about crying before every fight. You know, and you know, these are human beings. And you know, you're Mike Tyson. he was probably crying just as much because he didn't want to hurt somebody as not wanting to get hurt, you know? And that's just the reality of the sport. Now, that failure, though, of your courage birthed a lot of courage, didn't it? Because you recognized it. But if you would have made excuses and blamed it on you know, I didn't make the Olympics because I was robbed or this or that or the other thing, or my coach let me down, or that my mom was not letting me focus on my training. You could have made 1,001 excuses, but instead you correctly assessed and you said, I failed the team. I didn't want it bad enough. Did you know that at the time? Did you know right away, this is my fault?
Yeah, I did know right away because I was distracted. I wasn't focused, and it was just so unfortunate. I was devastated because I could not believe the most important opportunity in my life, I wasn't focused. So I knew it right away. I knew that when I was – so I was a 7-time national champion fighting 10 years of boxing. So 7 of those 10 years, I was rated number one in the country. The only times, in my opinion, I wasn't rated number one in the country was because I wasn't entirely focused. And the times I lost, you know, I'd lost to Vernon Forrest, who became a world multi-world champion. I lost to a 3-2 decision to Tyrone Mallett, who became a multi-world champion as well. So I lost to some really good people when I wasn't number one. But I felt if I was focused, mind, body, and spirit, there was nobody that could beat me.
And it took courage to recognize that at the time, to not make excuses.
That's right. Yep, because you could say, you know, yeah, like you said, it's my coach's fault, or I didn't get sparring, and lots of reasons. But yeah, I always, you know, knew that I had to grind, and if I wanted to be a champion, I had to bring the best out of myself and others. A lot of, like I said earlier, when I talked about humility, a lot of people helped me with that.
And if that, probably that moment of failure birthed a lot of successes in your life.
Oh, that's the next virtue of perseverance. So if you, you know, perseverance is so important. If I would have, I remember when I fought my first fight and lost and I wanted to give up and I was crying, and my coach was like, don't give up, champ. You have natural abilities. You can become a champ. And then I fought my second fight and I lost again. And this time I really wanted to give up. I'm thinking to myself, man, there's nothing fun about entering that ring with that intense fear. Then you lose. Then you start crying in your humility. I told my coach, I'm done. And again, my coach said, don't be a quitter. You can become a champion. You can become a champion. Don't be a quitter. And he said it like 3 times. And he convinced me, and I felt the challenge that I wanted to take on. And look, I became a 7-time national champion, competing all over the world with the United States national boxing team, and got to go to Poland and see the good Polish people over there that weren't bullies like
Adam
in my neighborhood.
Quote unquote,
yeah,
Adam. Quote unquote,
yeah.
Adam.
Russia, you know, people were saying, oh, don't go to Russia. It's terrible. Man, we were playing cards and we didn't even understand each other, but we were laughing with each other, having a great time. You know, I would share my USA boxing uniform with them. They give me their Russia uniform in Barbados, where I saw what true poverty was like. You know, I thought I grew up poor. My mother was working 2 or 3 jobs. My father was gone, no support. Very humble beginnings, but I saw true poverty in Barbados. So the worldwide perspective that boxing gave me, along with those virtues, was so essential. And going back to the perseverance, so you learn how to fail. You learn how to lose, and you learn how to bounce back. And you learn what it takes to try to not fail. But the other thing is, when you get in the ring, you could lose, you could be humiliated, you could even die. So that courage that you have, but then once you lose, what did you learn from that loss? And how can you tailor your next training schedule, your next approach, so that you can win the fight? So a lot of times in life, it's those failures that allow us to learn and advance to our next level. I think about failures, and that helped me so much because I learned that by failing in boxing, I got better. And when I gave up boxing, I got into occupational therapy, and it's very hard. I took an OT entrance exam, and I scored embarrassingly low, but I persevered, and I worked really hard, and I graduated with honors. I got a 3.83 for my master's degree. I was the only student in my class to publish my thesis in the American Journal of Occupational Therapy. Then I take my first occupational therapy entrance exam so I can practice occupational therapy, and I failed. I didn't study at all because I thought it was an honor roll student. I thought it was smart, and I failed, and it was the biggest mistake I made in my life. Then the second time, I studied just a little bit because I thought that, well, I just barely failed, so I studied a little bit, and I failed again. And at the time, I remember, at the time, I was, like, crushed. I was like, I can't pass this test. I'm not going to be able to practice occupational therapy. I have no career. Why don't I go back to boxing? At the same time, I saw Vernon Forrest become a four-time world champion, a guy that I beat twice. I saw Jose Antonio Rivera, who I knocked out, become a three-time world champion. I thought, shouldn't I go back to boxing? And then I heard that echo of that voice, Shorty, that giant, telling me not to be a quitter. Don't be a quitter. And this time, I studied with the rigor and intensity. It took me to become an honor roll student to pass this darn test, and I passed it. And I had great opportunities with that degree. If I would have given up, I would have never rose to the CEO level where I'm at here today.
Yeah, you said in the book, Shorty was always there for you, and then you talked about when you first started going to school, there was an administrator that was pretty dismissive of you. And so perseverance, we have to persevere sometimes when we don't have that person putting their hand on their shoulder calling us champ, right? Did you have anyone in your college experience that was like the Shorty for you that put their hand on your shoulder and said, let's go, champ? We got this.
I was so driven that at that point that I didn't need so much of that. But I did have, there was a counselor when I went to UW Milwaukee that was very supportive as I came in. And so just made the process easy to understand. It really helped me along the way. So I'm very grateful to her as I came in. But, you know, obviously just the encouragement of my family, my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, but now is my wife, just friends along the way, and Shorty too. You know, Shorty was really devastated and hurt when I first gave up boxing. He didn't understand it, you know, but then later on, he was so, you know, happy for me. And now in hindsight, he tells me, man, you made the best decision giving up boxing. You've had a great life. So I've always had good people that have supported me along the way. But I also had this huge sense of conviction when I left the sport of boxing. I knew boxing, I was going to achieve success in boxing. You know, if you look at Vernon Forrest, Jose Antonio Rivera, all these other guys that I've competed with, Toron Millet, Winky Wright, you know, all those guys ended up being very successful, and I knew I could have been successful. So now I was going to take a different path. I wasn't going to be a millionaire through boxing. So I was very driven, and I wanted to give my best. And that's what I do. I give my best. I apply those same virtues to strive for greatness, whether it be as a husband, as a father, or as a CEO.
Yeah, you never stop being a boxer. You're just a boxer in a different ring.
Oh man, bobbing and weaving. You gotta roll the punches.
Speaking of bobbing and weaving, do you still, when you, every time you get in the mirror, do you shadow box? Do you shadow box in front? Do you see punches come? Are you walking down the street and all of a sudden you bob and weave? Uh oh. I do that and it embarrasses my family. I do it all the time. Oh,
it's
everywhere.
It's a habit. But I'll tell you, you have to bob and weave, you know, in life, right? And roll with the punches. Sometimes, you know, you got to just let it slide. And, you know, sometimes right now as a CEO, I don't have that cup, you know, and sometimes those low blows really hurt. But you got to take it in stride and learn. And that's the virtue of temperance. So I'm going to skip. We did perseverance. That's okay. About failure. But then temperance is about self-control and restraint and controlling your natural impulses. So what happens when you get hit with a low blow? You know, you get upset. You might want, maybe the referee didn't see it, but now you want to hit the guy back with a low blow because he did. Now the referee might see it. You could get disqualified. So you learn temperance. You know, before a fight, there's a lot of bad talking or smash talking, right? And you got to stay composed and calm and not let that get to your mind. And same thing with life. You know, recently I had a very, very horrible experience, and it wasn't that long ago. And it's by this executive who was essentially bullying me in a restaurant. And provoking me to fight him, and I remember.
Whoa! An executive was provoking you to a verbal argument or like a physical argument, a fight.
It was verbal, but clearly he was provoking me. Okay. And I honestly wanted to beat this guy up.
Okay.
With bad intentions. Okay. With really bad intentions. I kind of zoned out, but I just remember telling myself, I can't do this. And I remember telling myself, Lord, please help me. And when I said that, the guy left, and the waitress came, and then he left. And I remember after that, it was one of the most humiliating experiences of my life and one of the most terrible times of my life. And then I checked that in. I said, dang, that's bad if this is one of the most worst experiences of my life, just because of my darn pride. And I remember I went to my great friend that's connected with me, to the church with me. And he told me, and this is this guy can get kind of animated and he's very passionate. And he came with me with this really calm approach. He said, Hector, why don't you should give thanks to God that this happened right now during this time of Lent, because it was Lent. He said, you can identify with our Lord and lift it up to him for all the sacrifices that he has gone through for our salvation. And I felt so much better when I left that meeting. But check this out. What if I would have knocked this guy out? I would have been on the front cover of the Journal Sentinel. Hector Colon knocks out executive and now is fired from LSS. Or right. Even worse, Hector Colon knocks this guy out, continues to pummel him, kills him, and now is in jail. You know, for what? Because of my pride? This is an extreme example, but there's so many examples in life where we need self-control and restraint. I want to share something.
Hector, I think what I want to share real quick, I want to hit this point because what you just said, I don't think it's so crucial. You know, you and I grew up in neighborhoods where you had to fight to be just left alone.
Right.
And then so you learn a skill set. You learn when people are disrespectful to me, so the disrespect ends, you got to punch them in the nose. It works. It's like an effective way to manage your childhood, right?
Right.
It's like your dad taught you, hit him in the face. He's going to leave you alone. But then I moved to, a more affluent neighborhood when I was in seventh grade. And I fought every day from kindergarten till sophomore year in high school. But when I moved to this other neighborhood, they were shocked. They would insult my mother. They'd say whatever they wanted and I'd punch them. They would all look horrified. And so here's my point. I think that so many people who come from sort of scrappy communities, when they fight their way into the workforce, we're startled by is how disrespectful people are to each other. like what you had to experience. Do you know? And then we have these sort of, this is my weak spot. I once was upstairs in my office, and an investor in my films, this is one of the wealthiest guys in California, was in my office. I didn't come down yet, berating my staff, yet raising his, and I came down and said to one, a very wealthy guy, he had hired us to market his film. I didn't invest in us, but I said, you raise your voice to my employees again, you're eating your teeth, bro. Don't ever. And this guy's worth hundreds of millions. If you ever raise your voice at my staff again, you're swallowing your teeth. He looked shocked, but I still struggle with the self-control. And I thought a lot about this, that what I'm still grappling with is appropriate responses for a 12-year-old in my neighborhood to deal with a bully are not the appropriate responses to deal with a bully in my office. And that's what you were dealing with. You were dealing with Adam, right? But those guys that he never imagined that he was inciting in you an idea of punching him. It's not in his realm of thought, right? So those of us who fight our way into these places, I think this is very normal. I'm so glad you brought this up because, you know, just talking to you, I'm sure if I met you, I would never imagine that this guy would struggle with like what I struggle with all the time, which is, you know, don't bop this guy in the nose. So I'm glad you shared that. And I didn't want to interrupt your story, but I think so many of us struggle with that what you struggle with.
No, temperance is so important in life. You know, health, self-control, self-restraint, control your natural impulses. Do not do something that could ruin your life and your career. I don't know who necessarily the people that listen to your radio, but I'll say that, you know, Donald Trump. I think if Donald Trump had 0.01%, a little bit more temperance, he probably would have won this election in a landslide. And so it just shows by just, you know, maybe it's a little less tweet or a little less comment or, you know, and the outcome that it could have had in for him in that election. It's just an example of how important temperance is. You know, if I would have reacted, I could have lost my job, you know, but also maybe there's personal struggles. I can control that. Or somebody disrespects you or disagrees with you in the workforce. You know, you don't get mad at that individual. You listen, you learn, you have empathy, and you try to come to some common understanding. And you know what? At the end of the day, you may disagree, but that doesn't mean that person's a bad person. That doesn't mean that that you can't find common ground on 90% of other things. But a lot of times in our society, we disagree, and in our politics, it's so partisan, so polarizing, and we can't come together for the common good and do something great for all of us.
Well,
temperance plays a huge role there.
And I think that it goes back to Trump, the bullying. You know, I think he built his business up in a place where he's dealing with, you know, bankers, nameless, faceless platoons of bankers, labor unions, mob bosses. And right, this is how he grew up in, you know, New York in the 70s. This guy's trying to be involved in business, and think of who he had to deal with, you know, and he learned that you punch a bully in the face. And
that's right.
But again, I think everyone agrees. I bet his own wife, if she were, she'd say, yes, he could temper that a little more. And that's what we have to learn, that the skills that, and that's why I liked your book, because I'm a high school dropout with a GED, was raised by a teen parent who was raised by a teen parent, and I became a teen parent, sort of that cycle. And I've had to realize that a lot of the skills that I learned as a young person do not apply to life today.
Right.
A lot of my instincts are dangerous to my well-being and my success. And I think President Trump could, it's the same thing, right? And it's hard to understand what brought you to the table can hinder your progress. What got you this far can stop you from going further. Temperance is that virtue that can help us go beyond our child, you know, the impulses that we all have because of whatever we suffered as children.
That's right. And it's really that virtue that helps you pause and just reflect before you react, you know, to make sure, again, you're not doing something that can ruin your life and your career. So not a virtue you hear a lot about, but I think a virtue that's very important for life and leadership.
Yeah, because we live in a society that's driven by advertising and marketing, which wants us to be intemperate, right? Like we're driven to do what YOLO. Have you ever heard that expression, YOLO? You only live once, which I would say is the virtue of the modern age. It's the virtue of the gods of our city. That's the exact opposite of temperance. If it feels good, do it. Whatever your impulse is, do it. Satisfy every urge. Temperance says, put the brakes on that, cowboy. It's probably not the best way to go about living your life. It's probably the path, actually the path to destruction. Temperance is that virtue that stops us all from going off the cliff because we're all driven. If all of us, you know, if you remove temperance from any one of us, we would immediately go off the cliff into catastrophe.
Right. Yep.
All right. What's our, we got one more, virtue here or two more?
No, we did. We did magnanimity, which is about striving for greatness, humility at its core, it's about serving others, courage, facing your fears, perseverance, about not giving up, and then we ended with temperance, self-control.
Oh, so we're done.
So we hit them all.
We've got the five pillars to achieve our New Year's resolutions. Now, do you have any New Year's resolutions?
You know, for me, I don't ever really have new things, but it's more of a continual, you know, effort to strive for holiness in my personal life. So attending daily mass, you know, prayers and reflections and gratitude, examination of conscience at the end of the day. So just a rigorous plan of life so that I continue to follow that plan of life. You know, same thing. I try to work out, you know, every morning. And, you know, even if it's a half hour, you know, I'm not training at the intensity of a boxer, but at least I'm getting something in to make sure that I'm relatively healthy and have a decent weight. So that is something that I continue. And then the third thing is the professional development. I'm always constantly learning. I'm reading lots of books. You know, right now I'm taking different courses or achieving different certificates, going to Harvard and things like that. And right now this year, I think I want to do I applied for an executive MBA and I got approved, but I think I might do the mini, it's called a mini MBA, and it's more like a 10-week course kind of certificate. And the reason why I think that that's the better option for me right now, because I just want to continue to learn. And right now I'm kind of busy with my book and with speaking engagements, and I want to do more of that, hoping that I reach out to more people to get more opportunities for paid speaking. But also I have a vision to be on a Fortune 500 corporate board, and there's a couple opportunities coming along that way. So I can't be too busy and doing an executive MBA in addition to doing all these things. So I am going to probably go this mini MBA, executive MBA route. So really, that's mind, body, and spirit approach, and that's not just a New Year's resolution. That's a way of life for me.
Yeah, well, praise God. Well, I'm thankful for you. I'm thankful for this book. I'm going to buy a bunch of copies and, you know, hand them out at the gyms that I go to. And do you ever go to the boxing gym anymore?
Well, yeah. When my coach Shorty invites me, obviously this pandemic for a year, but sometimes he'll ask me to come talk to the kids, and happily do that. You know, right now I'm on the U.S. Olympic National Boxing Board, so I'm the vice president of the board, and it's a great way to give back to a sport that helped create who I am, and I want to be there to ensure the safety and integrity and safety of the sport. but also to be there as a role model for these young, aspiring, really good athletes that they don't get taken advantage of by these professional promoters that truly are some of which are sharks and try to really take advantage of you. But then also just to give them a perspective on life and leadership in general through these virtues.
You know, that's a really good point. Just like in anything in life, when you have a young, talented person, there's people who want to exploit them. And when you have a young, talented person that doesn't have a strong family support system or community, then they're easy prey. And so you can find these guys in the boxing gyms. And I tell you, my favorite place in the world, don't get mad at me, Hector, is I prefer the boxing gym than church. God forgive me. I come back from the gym, I say to my wife, if I were God, you'd have to belong to a boxing gym to enter the kingdom of heaven, to enter eternity, because these young people are I love being around them. I love listening to them tell their stories like, oh, I work the night shift at FedEx, you know, so I got a fight coming up in 8 weeks. I'm working the night shift at FedEx and then I'm in there with them at 8 a.m. and I just see how hard they train and I look at how virtuous they are. How noble they are. Maybe many of them are young parents, young fathers. And I just like, you know, being in their presence because I admire them so much. And I know I'm around great people, but they also, like you said, they need mentors. And I'm glad you're on the Olympic Boxing Committee. Thank you for this book. Thank you for your personal apostolate and your professional career. And, maybe we'll get you down here to San Antonio. It's a big boxing community here. You know that, but they love.
I would love to. Let's hopefully after the pandemic, invite me. I'd love to be with you in person. I have a great friend. I don't know if you know Raul Marquez, who lives in Texas, Houston, but he's a Showtime commentator, 1992 Olympian. And one of those individuals that I've kept in close contact with. So I would be happy to be out there with you.
Yeah, you're right. If you come to Texas, we need not just do San Antonio. We have to set up a Texas tour. So we got to set up a Texas tour. We'll do all of Texas. And we should probably schedule it for February to get you out of Wisconsin.
Hey, I would love that. That'd be great.
All right, Hector Colon, thank you very much. Thank you for joining us on a weekend. I really appreciate it. And so again, Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. I'm going to have in the show notes how to get your book. If they want it on paperback, you know, you got to buy it. But so you know, if you get Amazon Prime, your book is free right now. So it's also available for anyone with Amazon Prime. They can go read the book right now at no cost. Is there anywhere else you want people to follow you? Are you on social media or anything like that?
Yeah, I have a Facebook page, Boxing Ring the Boardroom. So you can follow me on Facebook, or my direct website, HectorColonMKE.com. And you could purchase my book there as well. And you can get a signed copy if you request it. And that's another way to, if you want to book me for a speaking event, or buy my book, or just learn more about me and what I'm doing in the community, you can look that up on my website.
Yeah, I'll put your website and your Facebook page in the show notes, and I see a political career in your future. I don't know if you've thought about that, but you're the kind of guy I'd like to see be mayor of Milwaukee, maybe governor of Wisconsin one day.
Thank you so much. Right. You know, people keep saying that, but you know, I we didn't talk about this, but I used to be the director of Health and Human Services for Milwaukee County, and I often tell people that I've already done my purgatory through that role, and that was a great role. I learned so much, learned humility and leadership, but I feel good on this side where I feel that I can make more of a difference through my in my capacity as a president and CEO. So I want to help advance other good candidates that espouse some of these virtues that I talked about here today.
All right, Hector. Well, whether you're supporting someone else, whether you're on their team or they're on your team, keep up the great work. And I really appreciate all that you do. And it's been a privilege to have you on the Jason Jones Show.
Thank you so much, Jason. God bless you. I appreciate you so much and look forward to being with you in person, hopefully sometime in the near future.
I'm in Wisconsin about 10 times a year. So
great.
And every time, you know, you and I can go down to Rufus Sport together. I don't know if you've absolutely ever been down there. It's one of the best gyms in the world. And I love, I love popping in there.
Oh, Rufus is great. So Rufus played a key role when I was commissioner of boxing and mixed martial arts, formed an advisory committee to help develop the mixed martial arts rules. And we brought in UFC and Rufus was a part of that.
Well, he's a pioneer in kickboxing, pioneer in MMA and MMA. He produces great fighters. Again, when I'm in Wisconsin, I recently had a speech in Chicago and then I had to go to Green Bay. And I literally timed everything around stopping instead of getting lunch, going to train with the guys, Duke Rufus's guys, where he has UFC champions and just a lot of great young men and women from the Milwaukee area training. And again, it's just, to me, I always feel in awe. You know, you can't go to Yankee. This is why I want everyone to join a boxing gym. You're not going to be able to go and suit up with the Green Bay Packers, and, you know, and say, let me run some routes. No, you're not going to be able to do that. You're not going to be able to go into the cages to take some swings with the Yankees at spring training. But if you find your local boxing gym, you can, A, support a trainer, get private lessons or whatever to help him, meet great young people, and then just be inspired, be in awe. I skip rope. When I'm in L.A., I always train at Wild Card, a Freddie Roach's gym. And you know who's in – everyone's in there. And I just skip rope. I'll jump rope for an hour. But what I'm really doing is I'm watching these guys train. And I'm just in awe. I'm just – I admire them so much. And I always say to myself, how do I get to be in here right now looking at these guys train? And it's, you know, it's $15 for a month or $30 to – month membership at Wildcard. And then I'm skipping rope, watching the best fighters in the world, the best athletes in the history of the human family. And all anyone listening can do that. You can go find your local gym, your MMA gym, Muay Thai gym, boxing gym, and you can watch champions train, future champions train. And you might be a champion in your business, in your industry, and they can benefit from knowing you too. So I just wish everyone was involved in their local gyms.
That's awesome. That's the virtue of humility through boxing.
Amen. All right, brother. You get back to your family.
All right. Thank you so much. God bless you, bro.
Aloha. All right, everybody. That was Hector Colon. What a great guy. He's the kind of guy I need as a mentor. I need to keep his phone number in my phone. And I'm looking forward to getting to know him more. Order his book. I'm going to put the link for the book in the show notes. I have to give a speech on Freedom Plaza here in a couple minutes. So I'm going to close the show with simply this. This episode is being brought to you by MyPillow.com. Go to MyPillow.com, click on the radio listener box, use the code Jones for deep, deep, deep discounts. Also go to thegreatcampaign.org to become a monthly donor of the Vulnerable People Project. Any gift of $20 or more, you get a copy of my book with John Zmirak, The Race to Save Our Century. All right, this has been the first episode of a brand new year, the Jason Jones Show. Till next time, aloha.
This has been the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media.